Good morning. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting here with the host, John Hockenberry, and we're on the line with Gil Kerlikowske. He's director of the Office of National Drug Control Policy. You may know him as the Drug Czar, but we don't say that anymore.
Don't say that.
Sorry. Did I say it again?
Yes.
White House director of National Drug Control Policy. Well, from the rise in abuse of prescription drugs to the ongoing violence along our southwest border with Mexico to the tricky legacy of the war on drugs itself, Gil Kerlikowske has a lot on his plate. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
You're very welcome.
Well, we talked at the top of the program about whether prescription drugs, oxycodone, OxyContin, are this country's newest, biggest problem in terms of abuse. And your office released a report last month where you really hammered home that prescription drug abuse is the largest, the fastest growing sector of drug abuse in the country. Well, I want to point out that the death of Michael Jackson has sparked a huge conversation around this week, and we should be clear that there is no confirmation that prescription drugs played a role in Michael Jackson's death, or that he was using them. There's no confirmation that he was using them inappropriately, for that matter. We don't know that either. But isn't this a potentially important moment for you? Should Michael Jackson's death be viewed as an opportunity in some sense to talk about prescription drug abuse and the dangers of legal pain-killing drugs?
Well, I've been in office 7 weeks, and actually looking at the numbers and talking to people, I said some quotes about shouting this from the rooftops, and that was actually quite a few weeks ago. The numbers are startling. More people dying of an overdose, including prescription drugs, heroin, and cocaine, than are dying of gunshot wounds. I mean, that is truly significant. More young people entering into drug abuse through prescription drugs than other types of drugs. So these are all important. And, of course, the increase in people being admitted to emergency rooms for treatment.
What more can be done with these legal prescription drugs? I mean, of course, the delicate balance is here is that millions of patients rely on narcotic painkillers post-surgery and for other problems. And that the problem in pain management isn't too much treatment, it's too little. And doctors and patients know these drugs are important. So where's the delicate balance? Because they are so readily abused. How are you going to – your predecessors weren't able to find a solution. How will you?
Well, you're absolutely right that when used properly and when prescribed properly, for some people they just work absolute miracles. But there are a couple things that can be done. First of all, there's prescription drug monitoring laws, and about 33 states across this country have passed those so that there would be a better tracking system.
And doctors absolutely squirm under those laws. They squirm. They can't stand them.
Well, actually, the electronic prescription process, which is part of healthcare reform, is going to make it all that much easier. But it also not only cuts down on the potential abuse by a doctor over prescribing, but it also looks at the patients who are going to multiple doctors, which can be incredibly dangerous. So that's one thing. The other is the education process about for physicians. Those are all important steps that can be taken to limit this. And then, of course, educating parents. Certain drugs need to be locked up there. And, of course, there needs to be a drug disposal process because lots of people have a lot of drugs that are outdated or not used anymore in their medicine cabinets.
Well, Director, let me ask a question. And I'm wondering if this is fighting your policy at all. Has a mystique grown up around prescription drugs that begins to match the sort of traditional mystique of illicit substances, which have traditionally been the focus of drug policy directors such as yourself?
I would tell you that the mystique is more around the fact that people who are abusing these look at them as safer. They say, look, I know what I'm getting. It's a prescription. It's manufactured. I'm not buying it in a little foil or plastic packet off the street. Therefore, it must be safer. And in fact, we know from deaths and emergency room treatments that they are not safer. They are dangerous.
All right, Director, let me shift you down to the border for a moment. Your office, of course, has released its counter-narcotic strategy plan for the border region with Mexico, and previous White Houses have done the same. Can you give us a brief bullet point overview of your plan for the border in terms of drug interdiction and drug importation into this country?
Well, the Southwest Border Plan was released by myself, Attorney General Eric Holder, and Secretary Janet Napolitano from the Department of Homeland Security just several weeks ago in Albuquerque. What it involves is incredible amounts of cooperation and communication between Mexico and the United States. It means that all of the federal partners here in the United States are standing shoulder to shoulder and working closely together. But it also means that we are willing and able to help Mexico in this courageous fight against the cartels.
With weapons?
Not just from the law enforcement side, but also from their own population, which has addiction issues.
Oh, okay. Does that mean money? Does that mean money and weapons as well for them?
Well, the Merit Initiative includes several hundred million dollars in assistance to Mexico, and we know that the better Mexico does in protecting the border and reducing its own addict population and prevention, the better we'll all be also in the United States.
All right. Well, while we're talking about the border and about drugs over the border, let me have you listen to your cabinet colleague, Secretary Hillary Rodham Clinton.
Our demand for drugs is what motivates these drug gangs. I mean, if they didn't think they were going to make a bunch of money across the border, they'd go into another line of work.
So that's the domestic aspect of this and demand for drugs. Director, I have to ask you, every single director of the Office of Drug Control Policy that I've ever covered has talked about demand reduction here over the border, and it always seems like social conditions, economic issues are what really drive drug consumption in this country, nothing that the White House really does.
Well, I think there are a couple things that the White House actually can do and this position can do, and that is rather than talk about it as demand reduction, we talk about prevention and treatment. We talk about the enforcement piece, and we talk about a balanced approach. Quite frankly, the attention to prevention and treatment has not received the same level of focus that enforcement has. That doesn't mean we'll take away resources from enforcement or what we're going to do in other countries, but it does mean that those two things, prevention and treatment, should stand on an equal footing with the other things I mentioned.
Well, and certainly that strategy is part of the reason why you were nominated for this position, because of your success using that strategy in the community of Seattle. But I'm wondering, yesterday the president of Colombia was at the White House. There's a major military effort to interdict drugs in Colombia. Do you support that policy, or did you say anything to the president of Colombia to suggest that you would love for that kind of policy to be rolled back?
I met with President Uribe in the morning prior to his meeting with the president, and certainly the successes that have occurred in Colombia are well known to people in the United States. There is less violence. There are less coca production occurring. They have had very difficult issues to confront, much as President Calderon is confronting in Mexico. So our support for what truly has worked in Colombia, I think, was made known to him.
All right, Director. I know we're kind of jumping around a little bit, but I really want to bring it back to the domestic scene. One of the things you're known for in Seattle is a de-emphasis on interdiction and prosecution of marijuana possession in the community. And I wonder what your attitude is towards marijuana, not legalization, of course, but
no, ask him about legalization.
Well, I think decriminalization.
He's from Seattle.
well, decriminalization was the issue there, wasn't it? And whether or not we're going to continue to spend billions in resources in prison space on marijuana. And I want to nail you down on whether you think possession of, I don't know, a quarter ounce of marijuana should still be a punishable offense.
You know, marijuana has no legitimacy. It's a Schedule I drug, meaning it has no medical assistance, et cetera. It's illegal, and certainly when you look at the increases in the THC, the potent part of marijuana, it's a cause for concern. If you look at the number of phone calls that come into hotlines about people requesting help, marijuana is very, very high on that list. And, you know, I think it's a mischaracterization to say that I de-emphasized marijuana, et cetera. All police departments, law enforcement agencies have finite resources. We direct those resources to the things that are most dangerous to the community.
Well, from a law enforcement perspective,
that are most dangerous.
Do, from a law enforcement perspective, do you think that marijuana is a top priority?
I think from the trafficking and the amount of money that has been made by cartels and the amount of marijuana that comes across the borders, these are still significant law enforcement issues. There are also issues that in our federalist system that that the states look at quite individually.
Right. Certainly California has with their medical marijuana, and I think about 10 other states too. All right. Director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy, Gil Kerlikowske, thank you for joining us, for updating us on domestic drug policy and policy at the border.
Good. Thank you.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.